We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, my name is Will M. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 14, 1988. The most important thing that has happened to me in my whole life has been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and maintaining my work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Without it, I would not have the wife I have, the children I have, the home I have, the car, the retirement, the beautiful life I have. I'd have nothing without it. In fact, I would be dead and probably would have died around January or February 1987. What happened to me? I did not start on life thinking I was going to be an alcoholic. I had, looking back, a pretty idyllic childhood in Iowa City, Iowa. I was born in 1947, February 13, 1947, between Abraham Lincoln and Valentine's Day. So I always thought of myself as born between truth, which Abraham Lincoln emblemized for me, and love, which is St. Valentine's Day. I felt very fortunate to be born on the day I was. I was the first child, the first grandchild, so I was spoiled, and everybody was crazy about me. My poor sisters who came along later took a back seat, literally, to me. Whenever we went somewhere with my father, I got to sit in the front seat with him, and they were forced to sit in the back seat. So I really had a very happy time as a kid. I don't remember being troubled too much until about the fourth grade when I started hearing my parents fighting at night behind a closed door. I tried to listen in to what they were saying. I heard the one word once when I was in fifth grade, divorce, and it scared the heck out of me. I think what was going on is my father was a heavy drinker. He was doing things that made my mother angry and they would fight about it. That's what I came to surmise later. But I tried to run away from home. I ran away for a day, got down by the railroad tracks, was about to hitch a freight to New York. That was my plan as a fourth grader. And remembered I had a parakeet to feed, went home and fed the parakeet, gave it water, and forgot about running away. I developed rebellion at an early age, around 12 or 13. I started resenting my father, and I began, I think, to notice his drinking. I remember noticing that he would have cocktails every day, and especially after work, and that his personality would change, and he'd become unpredictable, and usually very snide and arrogant and critical. And I remember hearing him throw up one night. He was running for city council in Iowa City, Iowa, and he'd been to a fundraiser, and he was throwing up in the toilet, which my mom told me was due to his drinking. So I got this awareness that my dad was a drinker, and I didn't want to be like him at all. All of that, of course, changed when I was 16 years old. He went out of town with my mom. He had a liquor cabinet. It was in the sort of an entryway to our house. It was unlocked. It was full of every kind of liquor you could imagine. So my friends Ron and Franz and I decided one night to liberate some of his liquor. We filled up these big glasses full of every kind of liquor we could put in there and topped it off with Pepsi Cola and chugged it down. That was my first drunk. I was 16 years old and it changed everything for me. I was a shy, quiet kid, afraid of girls. I was getting 2 A's and 2 B's in high school the sophomore year, and I went on that semester after I started drinking to get 2 D's and 2 F's. I started being truant from school. I had a friend who had forged notes for us, and I started absenting myself from school to have fun. On the day John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I had a car, a 1950 Dodge Wayfarer that I was driving around town in. It was spray painted on the side of it in bright red lettering on each side, Hatari, H-A-T-A-R-I, Hatari for a 1962 John Wayne jungle movie about that involved vehicles that went through the jungle, smashing down trees and chasing after animals. Well, within a short time of my drinking, Atari was driving through jungles in the wooded areas near us and knocking down trees and then knocking down street signs and all kinds of things just for a lark. And this was while I was sober. So the alcoholic thinking had set in early and the anti-authority thing had set in. I got expelled for 3 days for leaving campus at lunch when I wasn't supposed to. By the time I ended my senior year, I was on juvenile probation. I forgot to mention that my parents tried everything they could to get me to stop drinking. They made me sign a contract with a lawyer, but I quickly breached the contract. They sent me to a military school, Kemper Military School, 360 miles away from where we lived, for a semester. And my two D's and two F's rose to number three in the class. I made the Military Honor Society, the Athletic Honor Society, the Academic Honor Society, and it proved to me that geographics work. I didn't get the idea it wasn't being sober that worked, because I was sober the whole time as a military. It was that geographics work. That was the lesson I took away from that. Anyway, by the time of 1965, I was a full-blown teenage alcoholic and was given the choice of going to the United States Army for 3 years, which I really wanted to do. I wanted to become a paratrooper, or go to the Boys State Reformatory in Eldora, because I was repeatedly arrested for public intoxication, and the judge had labeled me an incorrigible youth, which I was. I was an incorrigible youth. So I went to the Army. For most of the time in the Army, I got along fine because there were a lot of heavy drinkers like me, and it was not a problem. I did not stand out because of my drinking. However, the guy in my team, my United States Army Pathfinder team, Jim from New York, was 26 years old, a draftee, the oldest guy in our company other than the officers and non-commissioned officers. He was a private, and he drank like I did, except I think he drank even more than I did. He'd been court-martialed for getting drunk on guard duty, supposed to guard the colonel's tent, interior guard duty when you're not out in the field. He'd gotten drunk and fired his rifle up at non-existent attacking Viet Cong. I did the same thing a few months later, except I passed out and I had a monkey at the time named Joe. Joe and I got drunk at a party. We went out to be on guard duty. We both passed out and I was awakened in the morning by a lieutenant looking over me who had my rifle in his hand. And I got court-martialed and sentenced to burn poop. That's poor kerosene and poop for 30 days when I was back in the rear area for that. But it was the only trouble I got in the Army. It was an Article 15, so it didn't affect my permanent record, didn't make me subject to dishonorable discharge. I got out of the Army thinking, really, without consciously thinking, I don't have a problem with alcohol anymore. And within a month, I was arrested for public intoxication for kicking out the windows at the University of Iowa in a building in Jessup Hall in a blackout. I had no memory of it. The police officer showed me my boots and showed me the splinters of glass in them and the frayed leather. That was the evidence that I'd kicked out these windows at the University of Iowa. So that was my last arrest, public intoxication, in 1968 until 1985. I was arrested many, many years later for my first driving under the influence charge. It happened to me that even though I'd done so poorly in high school, I ended up with a 2.14 grade point average. When I got out of the Army, I sort of grew up and I took all the passion I had for life and put it into schoolwork and got a 3.72. Undergrad GPA was a Phi Beta Kappa. Went to graduate school, earned a 4.0 straight A average, got one of the two research fellowships granted to the class, went to law school, became the valedictorian of the law class, and I was an academic star everywhere I went, because I just poured my heart and soul into it and somehow managed to keep the drinking to weekends. I would get drunk and have to have my wife drive me around, and I would do foolish things and act like a dumbass, excuse my language, on weekends. But I behaved during the week. I compartmentalized my alcoholism. In 1980, my wife, after 13 years and two children, decided she'd had enough of my selfishness and my drinking and demanded the divorce, which I granted right away and gave her everything she wanted. And there began the tailspin from 1980 to 1987. I sank into that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that's talked about in the big book. I came to know the four horsemen, which are described in the last story, A Vision for You, in the big book. I felt oblivion and an awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I felt them every morning. By this time, I was married to my second wife, a flight attendant whom I'd met on a flight to Hawaii. I moved in with and married 2 months later. She had had it with me in 1987. She has staged what I would learn was an intervention on January 21, 1987 at Hayward Hospital in California. I was told I was going in for a physical, which I was told I needed. I had tried 5 cases back to back as a public defender in San Francisco, which was more than anybody else was doing at the time. And I was exhausted, so I agreed to the physical. The doctor who conducted the physical, it turned out, had a certificate on his wall. I noticed only very late in the interview. He was a member of the National College of Alcoholic Medicine or something like that. He was a specialist in alcoholism. I didn't notice that at the beginning. The doctor was clever. He knew that I was a lawyer, so he began treating me in the third person, the patient, he would call it, and I'd call the patient also, just kind of humoring him. He would say, the patient has extremely high blood pressure. And I noticed that something like 180 over 100. The patient, he told me after he had taken an EKG, which I knew about electrocardiogram, said the patient has cardiac arrhythmia. And I could see the irregular blips and blops in the chart and knew that that was cardiac arrhythmia. I'd been a lawyer who sued doctors for malpractice. I knew what cardiac arrhythmia was. And then he did something really astounding. He handed me his stethoscope and let me put it in my ears and let me put the little thing on the heart. And I could hear my own heart going blip, blop, blip, blop, blip, blip, blop. That was the irregular heartbeat, the cardiac arrhythmia at work. I could hear my own body being mortally ill. Now, that should have been enough for me to want to quit drinking. Just these vital signs are the worst they've ever been in my whole life. He suggested I might want to check into the hospital because he said, you may very well die if you continue to drink over this weekend. And I thought for a moment, and I I was terrified. I could not imagine a life without alcohol. I couldn't fathom it. So I said, doctor, it's Super Bowl Sunday. It was Super Bowl Sunday coming up, and I didn't know who was playing in the Super Bowl, but I did know it was Super Bowl Sunday, and that was a big, big, big drinking day for me. So I wanted to have one last hurrah. This was like a Friday night, and I wanted to have a great weekend, and then Monday I'd gladly check in the hospital. The doctor wouldn't let it go. He said to me, and this is the first time he used the word during our conversation, alcoholics, he started. Alcoholics lose their sense of humor. They lose their ability to empathize, to sympathize. They lose their sense of kindness. They end up with nothing but pity, self-pity and anger. And he was describing perfectly who and what I had become. I was someone who hadn't laughed in 6 months at least. I woke up every morning fearful and then spent the day in self-righteous anger. I alternated between extreme fear and extreme anger. That was my life. I was being cut off from my family. The wife I was married to at this time, the second wife who staged the intervention, said I was an old man and my kids didn't want to have anything to do with me. I was 40. I said to the doctor after that, I will consent to check in the hospital. So he immediately prescribed Librium, which was given to avoid delirium tremens, which would have been clearly present had I gone trying to go, had I tried to get sober without these pills, I would have gone into DTs. He put me in a hospital bed, and before retiring for the night, a young man who was also in this ward of apparently recovering alcoholics and addicts asked me, what's your drug of choice? I was so arrogant, I sneered at him, Chablis. I didn't tell him that the Chablis I was drinking was not in little flutes in Napa Valley with bottles that sold for $5 or $10 a piece or whatever the going price was. It was like $1.25 a gallon at Safeway, and I drank it at room temperature from a coffee cup until I started getting double vision and passed out. That was my Chablis. Anyway, I slept that night, was there a day or two longer, and they gave me a copy of a book as I was leaving the hospital that they said would be very helpful to me. It was a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, third edition. So I believe I went in about January 25, 1987. By January 31, 1987, I actually began to read the book for the first time. And I wrote this inscription, on a BART train on a sunny green afternoon, I start the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, the Talmud, the Bhagavad Gita. After all, I am somewhat eclectic. WKM. Those are my initials. What an arrogant twit I was. So full of myself, thinking this was just going to be like another class in world religions, a lecture, and I was going to read this and it would be intellectually interesting to me. I did not realize that this book and the program was going to change everything and everybody around me as well as myself. I struggled for the first year and a half. And I struggled because I lacked the capacity for honesty. I, who had grown up in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln, thinking myself so cash register honest, such a great honest person, would never do this and never do that. I had lied to myself about my need to drink and my desire to drink, and I kind of lied to everybody else. My first AA meeting in sobriety, I went to an atheist and agnostics meeting in Hayward after getting out of the hospital in Hayward, and I hated it. It was just a bunch of men raging about God, it seemed like, and they seemed very unhappy, and they spent most of their time, I thought, criticizing God. And I was an atheist anyway, so I agreed with them. But that wasn't, I couldn't see that being very helpful, so I didn't go to any more AA meetings. I was given Anabuse, a prescription, when I left the hospital. By the Monday after I left the hospital, I think I got on a Sunday morning. By Monday, I was having one beer with dinner with my Anabuse prescription. By Tuesday, it was two beers. My wife, who had just paid $2,000, her life savings, for this intervention, was looking on in horror as I'm sitting there drinking beer, and she knows I'm on Anabuse, and my face is bright as a lobster, red, horribly red. She's shocked. She said, basically, you're going to kill yourself. And I realized I was if I continued taking Anabuse. So I stopped the Anabuse, but continued the drinking intermittently, periodically. Finally, by February 1987, a month later, I realized I was never going to be able to quit drinking unless I got away from everything, including my job, my wife, everything. I realized I needed a program. I talked to the Veterans Association Administration, got a place at Fort Miley Veterans Hospital in San Francisco, and started a 28-day program on February 17, 1987. That night of check-in, the psychiatrist said to me that there was a requirement of going to six AA or NA meetings a week to be part of the substance abuse referral unit, this 28-day program. I'd not been told about that, and I felt like I'd been defrauded. And I said, well, just a minute, doctor. Hold on. I got to call my wife. I need to talk about this. So I left his office, found the payphone, called my wife who'd spent her $2,000 trying to get me sobered up, my second wife, and told her about this, that I had no intention of going to AA. They didn't tell me about this when I signed up for the program. She said, what are you going to do? Go back to your office and say you quit the program because they made you go to AA? That was a daunting prospect. So I put my head down, trudged back into the psychiatrist's office, and told him I was ready to go. Toward the end of my entry interview, which I, by the way, I minimized my drinking so much, at one point he said, I don't really think you need to be here given what you're telling me about your drinking. Are you sure you're not hiding something? And I laughed, and he laughed, and he knew I was just a BSer. I drank a lot more than I let on. I did ask the doctor, I'm working on two books. I'm wondering if I could bring my electric typewriter to the program and work on these two books. He smiled at me and said, isn't that a little like Nero fiddling while Rome burned? And I laughed and said, I guess so. He said, no, you're going to be busy. You're going to have plenty to do. You can't bring a typewriter. You can't work on books. This is a recovery program. So reluctantly, I gave up the idea of finishing these two books while I was away from my wife. The first day I woke up in the program, which was the next day, it would have been, I think it was February 16th when I was admitted, and February 17th when it was my first full day in the program. I went to an AA meeting near Fort Miley Veterans Hospital in San Francisco. It's on the campus. And I heard a man speak who touched me because he had a raspy voice. And he said he'd been given 3 months to live. He was our secretary. He'd been alive for 5 years. And that got me because I thought, wow, he had 3 months to live and now he's here 5 years. And he asked all of us who are newcomers to raise their hands. And I saw hands go up all over the place because we're all from the treatment program. My hand went up. I don't know why. And we went around the room. And when I said, I am an alcoholic, tears came streaming down my cheek, and I shook, and I realized this is the first time in public I have said this, and it's true. I had heard at the meeting that alcoholism is a disease, not a moral problem, although it has moral implications and associations. It's a disease. I was so relieved to hear that. I just thought I was a bad person and that I needed alcohol to function. That I was evil, secretly evil, and hiding it from people. But it was basically the alcohol that was bringing out the worst in me, or allowing me to behave at my worst. So I went through the 28-day program, was elected president of the class. And there was a song by Bill Withers, Lean on Me, that was real popular at the time. And ever since that 28-day program, whenever I hear Lean on Me played by anybody, including Bill Withers, I think of the guys. And they were all veterans, mostly all Vietnam-era veterans that were part of the program. I got out of the program, went back to my job, got back on BART, rode from Hayward to San Francisco. As I'm walking to work the first day, I see a man who had 90 days of sobriety, who was a cook at the program and who popped into our meetings, drunk and panhandling in a grassy meadow on the way to the Hall of Justice, where I worked as a public defender. This guy I'd seen only weeks before was a pillar of sobriety, 90 days, old timer, drunk. Within a week or two, I met another young African-American guy in a holding cell. He was one of my clients who was arrested for drug possession and drug trafficking. So two of the people I knew in my program were drunk and gone within less than a month of me seeing them sober. It had been suggested to me that I do a follow-up program that I really needed to do aftercare, but I didn't take that suggestion. So I slipped and slid for a year and a half, periodically getting drunk every time it was chip time. At 90 days, I went to the High Noon, a gay and lesbian group in San Francisco and got my 90-day chip and then promptly went to Jerry's Inn, which is near the birthplace of American author Jack London, an alcoholic who died at 40. Went to Jerry's Inn and ordered 4 vodka Collins to celebrate my 90-day chip. I got drunk at 6 months, 9 months, and possibly a year. No, it wouldn't have been quite a year. It just, I would do it, and I would never tell my sponsor in advance. By the way, I asked a colleague of mine, Bruce H., to be my sponsor when I got back to work. I wouldn't tell my sponsor, Bruce H., that I was going to drink, but afterwards I confessed it. He said these things that kept me alive to this day. Will, don't beat yourself up. Keep coming back. It keeps getting better. He's still my sponsor today. I talk to him every Tuesday on the phone. We've had a good run. We worked the steps, especially steps 4 through 9, at least 25 to 30 plus times over the 35 years I've been sober. Most of the steps 4 through 9 were regarding my alcoholic father, who never founded into the rooms and who somehow managed to maintain a business and get through life as a functional, though mean-spirited alcoholic who lived alone at the end because nobody could stand to live with him. I managed to have a relationship with this guy. The gifts of sobriety have been this. The biggest one is living amends. I did my 4th step, wrote down all the people I was angry at, and of course, by the time it was time to do step 8, most of the people on the 4th step list were on the 8th step amends list. I started with my mother and father. I went to them and apologized for my drinking and the consequences it had caused them and the heartache I'd brought them. And that was a mere apology. I spent the rest of my life making living amends to them. I visited them every year on their birthdays. And I'd spend 3 days because that's all I could stand to be around them. They'd get on my nerves and I'd get on their nerves after 3 days. I sent them cards and flowers every holiday. Thanksgiving, Christmas, their birthdays, Mother's Day, Father's Day. I did that over the decades. In 1995, I started calling each of them once a week and talking to them, which they were astounded. They wondered what I was calling, wondering if I was hitting them up for money after I'd been 7 years sober. I ended every conversation with, "I love you, Mom," or "I love you, Dad." These were German people, German background people. They didn't hug, they didn't kiss, they didn't say "I love you" ever in public that I know of, not to any of their children, certainly not to their mates. And my mom would say, "Well, I love you too." And my dad would say, "I feel the same about you." It took them a while before the phrase would roll trippingly off their tongues, "I love you." But I taught them how to say that by saying it over and over and over again. On the last days of their lives, I was with them. My mom fell in January 2017 and had to be admitted to a nursing home. We made plans, my sisters and I, to bring her back to California from Iowa to California so that she could be near her relatives at the end and we could see her. I was going to ride cross country in a medical van with her with snacks and stuff, telling stories while we rode across the country. Her condition worsened and she decided she didn't want to leave Iowa. So I visited her 5 times between January and May. I was with her the last 12 days of her life. I went to her to the shows they have in those places where the entertainers come around and do songs. And we sang together, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," about the death of a mother. And she sang it with vibrant gusto. That was 2 weeks before she died. Toward the end, she sunk into a coma. She rarely came out of it. One time she did pop up when I walked in her room because I was visiting her. I was with her every day. She said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Will, your son." She said, "Have you been drinking?" And I laughed. I said, "No, Mom. I've been sober 29 years. I think that's what it was at the time. She just snorted, "Okay." And that was it. And then she sank back into the coma. Another night, I had a picture near her of her mom and her sisters taken in 1935 when she was about 7 years old. Their sister was nine. She started talking in sort of a gibberish. I can only describe it as a mental fugue and pointing to them. And I talked back to her. I got the nursing staff to bring us a plate of cookies and coffee. And I stayed up with her for an hour just talking to her as she talked in this babble. That's all I can say. That's the last conversation I had with her at 9:10 p.m. on May 4, 2017. I was watching her breath, listening for it. We'd go over and put my ear next to her mouth once in a while to see if she was still breathing, and she hadn't breathed for quite a bit. So I went in and told the nurses, I think she's gone. They confirmed that she was gone. I sat there with her. I went out of the room while they cleaned her up, you know, crimped up her hair, put her in a nice bathrobe and stuff for going away. A woman from the crematorium dressed in an elegant evening gown came in a Cadillac limousine, strapped her into a purple body bag, plastic body bag, and zipped it up to her chin. It was going to roll away. And I said, it's okay. You can zip it all the way. She's gone. And so she zipped it up, and I watched her being wheeled away on this elegant rolling gurney in a purple bag to a Cadillac limousine to her final end, which was a crematorium. I did the same for my father 2 years later, December 12, 2019. I was with him the last day of his life, telling him stories about travels we'd done together. We took a boat trip from Northern Iowa to New Orleans. We went to Memphis, Nashville, and all other places on a road trip, and I just regaled him. I couldn't understand him at the end, but he squeezed my hand every time I came to the good part of a story. He died as I was going out for food for his home healthcare worker who was seated beside him. He chose to die in my absence, I guess, figuring his work on earth was done and we'd made peace. In the last year of his life, I gave him a book I'd written about him and me. It was a 504-page memoir. He loved it. It's dedicated to him. I'd given my mom a book earlier about her life as a girl up to age 19. I wrote books about each of them as living amends. So the other living amends I made was to the three of four wives I've had. The first wife always treated me kindly since that she divorced me in 1980 for drinking, and I always treated her kindly. We never said a bad word about each other. But I went through the years thanking her for being a wonderful wife and producing two wonderful kids. I still love her. She loves me, but not in the romantic or we want to be married to each other way. She married a second husband who drinks heavily like she does. And they had buy wine by the case. And they're sometimes intoxicated and sometimes say things that their children wish they wouldn't. But that's their business. It's not mine. It's none of my business. I'm here to be of loving support to her for all the days she has on earth. I see her grandchildren's soccer games, baseball games, football games, things like that. My second wife, a black woman from the South, has spent $2,000 to get me sober, a flight attendant from World Airways. After our divorce, she went to live in Stone Mountain, Georgia, and I call her every year on her birthday. I listen for at least an hour to whatever she has to say, and she's happy to have someone listen to her. She lives alone. I think she feels good having company. She knows and trusts me. And after an hour, I say, well, I've got to go now. I visited her once in 2019 and got her to let me take a picture of her in her home in Stone Mountain, Georgia. I gave her $1,000 once to fix the roof. She never asked for anything. And we have a good relationship. It's a once a year reminder. I thank her for saving my life. And we always end it with, I love you, Latrice. I love you, Will. And that's it. My third wife, whom I'm going to see today, actually, after this session in the afternoon, I take her to lunch every day on her birthday and listen to her for an hour. I was not a good listener. I would cut people off when I was drinking, but I learned to be a good listener. I try to make my prescription for life 95% listening and 5% talking. Not always successful at that, but I try to make it. I try not to finish people's sentences, which I used to do for my wives. I'd figure where they were going and realize they were doing it too slowly and interrupt them and finish their thoughts. They did not appreciate my help, so I've stopped doing that. So I have a great relationship with wives 1, 2, and 3, and the fourth wife, whom I have been married to for 22 years, loves me completely because I made a decision to stop looking for Miss Right and try to become Mr. Right between number 3 and number 4, and to let the universe unfold and not pursue things. And this fourth wife was a woman I'd known at work for 14 years I'd known her at work as a friend, and it just evolved into a friendship and then a romance and then a marriage, and it's been a very happy one. She brought along a daughter whom I love terrifically. So I've got 2 kids by the first wife and one child by the fourth wife. I love them dearly. I've got 4 grandchildren. I love them dearly. And the way I make living amends to my children is I go to see my son Tom and his 3 kids and his wife every Thursday. I feed their dogs and take the oldest dog, who's the grandpa of the group, Benji, for a walk around the block, a poop, sniff, and pee tour, and let him take as much time as he wants. He's so excited. His tail is wagging so hard, I'm afraid he's going to have a heart attack every time I see him, but he gets so excited for the walk. And so do I. I love the walk with the old guy. It's a couple of grandpas walking around a long block. I see my daughter by the first marriage every other week in Sacramento, and I walk around the state capitol. She works nearby at the Court of Appeal, and I see her just about every other week. I see my grandchildren as often as I can. I grew up. Sarah, one of my grandchildren, used to have me visit every Monday when she was a little toddler. I'd babysit for her, take her on tours all over Sacramento, take her to all the museums and stuff. And she's agreed to become the family historian after I died. Presently, I'm the family historian. In sobriety, I've managed to have a fruitful legal career, to be held in somewhat in esteem, retire, have enough money to live on for the rest of my life. And upon retirement in 2010, I decided to write books. I've written and published 10. The AA steps have allowed me to have no fear about expressing what happened in my life and being honest about it. I've talked honestly about my alcoholism, about my foibles, and about the ups and downs, the good and bad. And I published 10 books. 2 of those are military, army books of collections of stories of people I served with in Vietnam. Instead of shrinking away from people like I did when drinking, I've started going to U.S. Army Pathfinder reunions in 2018, published 2 books for them, and now I'm on the committee organizing them. I went to my second high school class reunion in a year this year, last week. I had no desire to go back to any class reunions ever because I was too embarrassed about my drinking. I couldn't stand to go back in sobriety. So a year ago in sobriety, I broke the barrier and have made some wonderful friendships. Many of those people are reading my books today. I am healthy, happy. I walk 1 hour a day in the hills and mountains where I live. Every so often, I take a 2 or 3 hour, sometimes 4 hour hike. I work out at the gym 3 times a week. I stretch every day. I have a beautiful relationship with my wife, all of my children and grandchildren. And I go to AA meetings. I have meetings 4 times a week. I'm of service at 3 of the 4 meetings. And whenever people ask me to speak or do anything else, I do it. I send out books to people who need books. I even deliver books during the pandemic. I delivered literature to people. I talk to my sponsor every Tuesday at 5 sharp my time. He's in the Philippines. It's 8 a.m. his time. We will maintain that relationship until one of us dies. And then I will continue, if I'm the one who survives, trying to be the kind of person that Bruce H. wants me to be as a sponsor. He wants me to live my richest, fullest, happiest life. And I'm doing that entirely because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak. Thank you for letting me be of service. The end.
Thank you, Will. That was so interesting. It must be really hard to maintain humility with everything you've done. What a life. What a beautiful life that sobriety has given you.
Yes, I've been gifted with a beautiful life because of AA, entirely because of that.
Yeah, and the work that you do, it seems like you continue to do it. So did I catch it correctly that you have had the same exact sponsor the whole time?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yep. Same guy from March 1987 when I got out of the program to today.
So let's go back to 1987 that you started working with him?
I was introduced to sobriety at the intervention in January 21, 1987. My sobriety date is June 14, 1988. Took me a year and a half to get permanently sober.
So let's go back to the beginning when you started working with Bruce. And specifically, because you had mentioned that you were agnostic, perhaps atheist in the beginning, how has your thoughts and opinion on that whole God, higher power thing changed over the years?
Well, I was a raging atheist who tried to convince my two children to be like me, atheists. And anytime they mentioned anything spiritual, I would shut them down. After coming to the program, I began to soften. And I realized I had to have a higher power if I was going to stay sober. So it evolved over the years, over several years, to where my higher power became like Bobby Bonds. Bobby Bonds is the father of Barry Bonds, probably the best baseball player who ever lived, although he's been accused of using steroids. His dad was his hitting coach. And I see my higher power as the hitting coach. The pitcher doesn't stop throwing strikes or balls or chin music that's throwing close to my face or curveballs or things I can't hit. But I learn how to adapt to each of the pitches that are thrown me by my higher power. My higher power coaches me in how to deal with the things life throws at me. And that's where my higher power is today. It's a Bobby Bonds kind of higher power. I call it HP. I call it God for short. But that's it. I study all religions. As you notice, I mentioned the Talmud, the Bhagavad Gita. I studied Hinduism, studied Buddhism. Once thought about becoming converted to Catholicism and started the RCA classes to become converted to Catholicism. But that was not for me. I realized I'm not suited for any organized religion. My religion or faith is AA. My spiritual life is AA. And it allows me to explore all these other things. I do all kinds of meditation by all kinds of teachers from all kinds of backgrounds. I hope that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It does sound like you are well educated on the topic. And the visual of the pitcher and adapting to the pitches resonates very well with me. That's a good one. What about mysticism and metaphysics?
I had a friend who was very much into mysticism. Her name was Esther. She ended up being my marathon and triathlon training partner. We did two marathons together and several triathlons, and we ran and bicycled and swam hundreds of miles together. She introduced me to yoga, which to me was a mystical thing at the time, and meditation, and past life regression. And she had a few other things that she introduced me to. But she was always a mystical thinker and always believed in a spiritual universe. So she introduced me to doing all these kind of mystical things. I listened to this thing called Insight Timer. Is one of the teachers who's pretty far out. She's like Esther is in her beliefs. I'm listening to mystical healing, travels to these waterfalls, which were golden showers of light. I listen to all kinds of weird stuff that I never would have thought of doing before I came to sobriety. I'm open to mystical pursuits. I'm open to the influences. I see coincidences everywhere. Things that are seeming contradictions aren't. They're just paradoxes. I see things drop in my lap just as I need them. For example, this wife, she was there for 14 years or so in my eyesight as a coworker whom I liked and admired. But it wasn't until I was ready to be open to the universe suggesting wife for me instead of me handpicking one with my list of attributes that I actually asked her to lunch and our romance followed. I wouldn't have been open to having anything to do with her before that. She's clean and pure and positive and doesn't drink maybe a thimbleful of wine a year. Now she doesn't drink at all. And she's generous, and she's just too goody-goody for me. I would not have married her when I was drinking. She would not have been attracted to me when I was drinking, and now I see the beauty in her. She's studying for a PhD at the age of 66, 12 hours a day, studying for a PhD, and I support that financially and spiritually and otherwise. So my mysticism has evolved into wonderful relationships.
That's really sweet. That's very sweet. I hope she gets to hear this. You mentioned when you were court-martialed and had to put gas on poop, which sounds terrible, that you had a monkey and you and the monkey got drunk. Did I hear that right?
Yes, you did. My friend Gerald Mixie and I both had monkeys. He had the first one named Sherry, and I later got one named Joe. We were in the 228 Pathfinder team, and when we'd be in the rear area together, which is rare, usually we're out on the field doing combat missions. But for Christmas, when they had a Christmas truce and New Year's and times like that, when we were together, we'd get drunk in this tent with our two monkeys. He'd play these songs like Tracks of My Tears and Mickey's Monkey by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. The monkeys would dance. We would dance. All these other Pathfinders would dance. We'd all get drunk. And then the monkeys and us, we'd all pass out together. And the monkeys would be, Joe slept wrapped around my head at night. And Mixie's monkey, I'd see her in the middle of the night kicking and preening his hair, you know, cleaning out anything in his hair, any bugs or any dirt or any soil. She'd be up in the middle of the night cleaning out the hair of the man she loved.
Okay, because you just threw that in there like it was normal, like me and my monkey got drunk.
We did. In fact, Mixie's monkey went through the stages of an alcoholic. She'd be real happy and real cheerful and vibrant at first, and then she'd get kind of surly, and then she'd become downright angry and ready to bite people, and then she would pass out, just fall back in her back and pass out. So his monkey went through all the perennial stages of drinking, just like a human would.
Okay. All right. I don't know what question to follow up that with. Let me pivot from your monkey. You...
That's a good sign. Okay, go ahead.
All right. I just have a few more questions. You talked about your going to law school and your graduate school, and you're just this academic star pouring your heart and soul into your academics. What do you pour your heart and soul in today?
When I retired, I took on a two-pronged mission: servant and writer. And I divide things by color code into self-care and servant and writer. I put servant first to the left because that's my top priority, is being a servant to other people. Includes all my program commitments, which are many. I listed a few, you know. The writer part is publishing 10 books, and I'm in a writer's group that's been meeting since 2010. They edit all my books and all my stories. I've probably written 50 stories, maybe, that aren't published yet. I've written and edited 10 books. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Yeah. So you pour your heart into being of service and writing.
Yeah. And part of the service is saying yes to everything my wife asks me. Whatever she says, I say yes to. That's kind of how it works.
What about self-care? You said you color coordinated. Your other one was self-care.
Oh, yeah. Self-care. I have an action plan, which is something I got from another fellowship. I do it every day. And it has, on the left side, it has the times. And to the right is the tasks. And they're little blocks related blocks, then it starts with meditation, prayer, four prayers, affirmations of spiritual readings and intellectual readings. One of the things I read is just for today, and it suggests I read something intellectually challenging every day. So I read a lot about the brain and about genetics. And I'm right now, Deepak Chopra and his coworker, who did a lot of brain research, I read that to be intellectually challenged. Let's see. Self-care also includes stretching. Miranda Esmond White is a woman who wrote a book called Aging Backwards several years ago. I read the book. I've been on with her 4 or 5 years, about 5 times a week. She literally believes you can age backwards, and I'm seeing improvements in strength, flexibility, balance, and I love her persona. Her persona is eternal youth, basically. She's in her 70s, like me, and she's the most youthful 70-year-old, 70-plus-year-old I've ever seen. I do workouts at the gym now, short weights workouts, not nearly the bulk as before, and the goal is not to develop huge, bulky muscles, but to develop flexible, usable, toning kind of muscles. I am working on raising my VO2 max. I don't know if you know what that is. It's a measure of your heart's ability to process oxygen. I'm working on that through the stationary cycle. I hike. The days I'm not in the gym, which is 3 days a week, doing that, I hike at least an hour a day in pretty hefty hills where I live. And I take tough trails, ones that are challenging to walk up and down, difficult for the ankles and the knees and everything else, to keep the balance, keep the strength, keep the power. And I meditate when I'm doing that. I listen to meditation tapes, and I try to be mindful with each step when I can. I eat well. I'm a gluten-free vegan. That's been an evolution too. I've been a gluten-free vegan for quite a while, vegetarian since 1983, and a gluten-free vegan for 5 or 10 years. I can't even remember when it started. I don't drink. I don't smoke. Don't do drugs. And I try to be kind to everybody. I have pictures of my children and grandchildren. As I say the third step prayer, I look at my 4 grandchildren, a portrait taken out by our fountain in the backyard, and say the third step prayer. I then pivot to a picture of me with my 4 children at my 7th birthday and say the 7th step prayer. I then swivel around to a whole family portrait of all of us at my 70th birthday and say the St. Francis prayer. And then I do the big one, the freedom from bondage prayer for the people I'm angry at, which include political figures and friends from the past who have turned in ways that are not attracted to me. I say the freedom from bondage prayer, where I wish for them every single thing in my life, which I would want for myself, I wish for them. And I wish it sincerely. And that bondage of anger that I have passes normally after 2 weeks, and they drop off the list. There's one political figure who I will not name, but you could probably guess, who has been on the list permanently. But each day I get a daily respite from the anger that would otherwise consume me if I thought about this person all day long. It's a way of letting this person go, kicking him, evicting him from the apartment he lives in my brain for a day. And I come back the next day and he's moved back in again. So I got to evict him every day. How's that?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. You sound perfect. What are you working on today? Where are you broken?
Perfectionism is one of my character defects.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I am working on the concept, I am enough. And I need to listen 95% of the time and talk 5% of the time. So really, I'm violating that rule.
Okay.
I'll have to make a lot of amends over the next week or two for all this talk today. What I'm working on today is becoming a better child. I forgot to mention, when my mom died, I got a granite stone with a first stanza of her class poem, which she wrote in our backyard. I go and talk to her every day. We scattered her ashes all over the backyard. I talk to her each day, and I tell her I'm going to try to be the best son, grandson, grandfather, uncle, friend I can be today. And I try to be that every day. What I'm working on right now is twofold in terms of the spiritual. I'm reaching out to a classmate who's depressed, has been on antidepressants for 50 years or so, we're going to start the Al-Anon program together. We're going to be accountability partners. And I'm teaching her. I've done Al-Anon. I've worked all the stuff. We're going to be accountability partners. I'm introducing her to Al-Anon because I think it would help her to feel better. I'm also working on reaching out to other high school people who have read my books and have become friends and supporting them. I'm inviting one of the high school friends to join my Saturday sing-along group that I do with two kids. They're 76. Two youngsters I went to high school with. I'm asking her to join the group. I'm always having goals, and I have books 10 and 11 in mind already. I'm working on both, and I shouldn't be. I should just be working on one. But book 11 is the history of my legal cases, starting with the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang, the Chowchilla school bus kidnappers, the Symbionese Liberation Army, the group that kidnapped Patty Hearst. I work for the firm that represented him, starting with that, going through my last case, which was produced as a documentary on PBS and shown nationwide at film festivals and on PBS. So that's a book I'm working on. I'm also working on a book about the high school class reunion. It'll probably be more like a pamphlet, between a pamphlet and a book. But I have a lot of photos and a lot of ideas, and I actually have 4 sections already carved out, like a prefabricated house where I'm working on sections of the house I'm going to build for the class and donate it to the class. It's going to be my gift to the Iowa City High School last picture show, last class reunion, which we just had a week ago.
Okay, so I was asking for weaknesses, and somehow you came up with more shit you're doing.
Okay.
What the hell?
Okay, weaknesses. I have to guard against arrogance, judgmentalism, intolerance, being unloving and unkind.
Okay, got it. I feel better now. Just want to make sure you're human.
I can slip into that quickly, and I'll occasionally say things to my children that I regret. Recently, I sent a quick email trying to be funny to my son about a sort of a lewd joke he made to me and my son-in-law, and I should have just left it alone, said nothing, but I threw back, "Do you want me to forward this to your wife?" I don't know why I did that. Once you press send, it's too late. I know that was mean-spirited or humiliating for him. I didn't intend it that way, but I pushed send too fast. So I got to stop doing that. Stop sending things on the impulse when I have a sense that might be wrong. And to my daughter, she's talking about her alcoholic boyfriend, and I casually ask, which Alan says you shouldn't do, "How's he doing on his program of sobriety?" "Well, he's hanging around a lot of sober guys and fighting fires. He has no program of sobriety. He promised to go in and hasn't." And she thinks it's going to be okay. And she thinks he's been sober for 6 months now, I guess. And I just hope it will work. But I made the mistake of asking that and then going on to say his plan to move to the East Coast and be gone 9 months a year. You know, you might find somebody else while he's at this East Coast. I shouldn't have said that. You know what I mean? That was too much information, unsolicited advice, negativity.
It's always my humor that gets me in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess those are the things I'm working on. The other thing I don't feel bad about, she had this idea of going to the National Guard to pay off all her school debts. I said, "Well, you know, there are a few problems. If you get deployed, you know, you could be gone for a year or more." And I've heard in the past, they kept people past their 6 or 7 year enlistment and kept them in theaters when there's a war going on. They have some kind of clause. You need to ask the recruiter, "If I go to war, can they keep me forever?" And I said, "By the way, people come back missing arms, missing eyes, missing legs, or dead." And she thought soberly, and I said, "By the way, you know, the mission of the military is to kill people, right?" And she thought, oh, she didn't think about that. I said, "Do you want to kill people?" She said, "No." So there's sometimes when feedback is helpful, I think it discouraged her from joining the National Guard, which she's not really cut out for. She's a do-gooder, social worker, kind person. So refrain from giving unsolicited advice is what I'm working on. Refrain from negativity of any kind. And promptly make amends when I'm wrong.
Glad to hear that you're human.
Yeah, I am.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now that you'd like to share?
Only that I'm extraordinarily grateful for this opportunity. I didn't realize until it was recorded how self-conscious I become being recorded. I never feel this way in front of a group standing live. Once I get going, you know, there's a reaction, there's laughter, there's pauses. talking into a phone for 45 minutes made me self-conscious. And I hope you'll edit out all the bad parts.
There won't be much editing, but yes, I will go through and remove ums. There was like one maybe. I'll remove coughs, that kind of stuff, so you'll sound clean. But it was fantastic. It was really well presented. I have one final question for the alcoholic out there listening and still suffering. What message would you like to leave with them?
My final message is that there's hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the thing I felt at the first meeting I went to in February 17, 1987. It's the thing I keep going back for now. I see hope in the eyes of other newcomers and in my own eyes. Every time I go to a meeting, I have hope.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.